Okay, so I think unless you were stranded on a desert island for the past year or two, you probably heard that the human genome has been sequenced, at least mostly sequenced. This is a summary of what was available as of a few months ago from the public sequencing consortium. And what you'll see is that about 30% of the genome is finished, high quality sequence, and perhaps 60% is in rough draft form right now. And there's also a private effort from Celera to also sequence the genome. So finished means, I mean, Phil Green is a better person to ask on this, but finished generally means one error in 10,000 bases, long contiguous sequence, hundreds of thousands of bases long. Draft means contigs that are generally unordered and unoriented. So you might have, say, in a 200 KB region, you have 15 contigs of varying sizes, and you don't necessarily know the order and orientation of those.
Why don't we have to know these prep contigs?
Because... because for political reasons. So I'm assuming that everyone is familiar with this, but just to review, DNA is double-stranded molecule, which is transcribed into RNA, and the RNA is then translated into protein, and there's a triplet code, which determines which triplet nucleotide sequences code for which amino acids. This is sort of a picture you would have in bacteria. However, in eukaryotes, this is complicated by an additional step. So after transcription of the RNA into the primary transcript, the RNA is generally spliced. So in this case, this part is called an exon, another exon, this part is called the intron, and the intron portion is actually spliced out of the RNA, and the exons are ligated together to form the mRNA. And then this mRNA then becomes a substrate for the translation machinery to produce protein. Okay, and this is really what makes eukaryotic genome analysis, especially higher eukaryotic genomes, which have lots of introns, much more complicated than bacterial genome analysis.
Splicing goes on outside the nucleus?
In the nucleus. Okay. So as a consequence, human genes have this split structure. So this is just a region of DNA sequence. In this case, it's a relatively small and simple human gene, the prostate-specific antigen gene. And the pink regions are the exons, and the black are the introns in between the exons. And so to find this gene, you need to sort of find all the little pieces and figure out how they're spliced together. And in this example, you'll see the introns are much bigger than the exons. And that's typical. In fact, this one is not even as extreme as a typical human gene. So today, I'm going to briefly review the exon-intron structure of genes, which will be relevant probably for my talk and Phil Green's later. This slide is from a linguistics conference I was at, so you can think of genes as having a grammar. And I'll briefly review my GenScan algorithm, which is actually several years old, but I think provides a sort of a background for what I'll talk about later. Talk about models of exon-intron sequence, and then how do you integrate extrinsic information, in this case, similarity to known proteins, to more accurately identify gene structures. And this is a new algorithm we've developed called GenomeScan, which is in press, and I have a preprints if anyone is interested. And then toward the end of the talk, time permitting, I'll talk about some of our work on the RNA splicing code. In some cases. Most introns appear to be constitutive, but there's also many examples of alternative splicing when you may or may not splice out a given intron in a particular situation. So a typical human gene, now we know, this is kind of an old slide, but now we know that a typical gene probably has about 10 exons based on the genome sequence. You have a promoter, a region in the DNA sequence, which directs transcription to begin here, say. You have a bit that doesn't get translated into protein. There's an initiation codon, ATG, then intron, exon, et cetera. And finally, the stop codon directs the stop, the end of translation, a region, another region that's not translated, and then a polyadenylation signal, which marks the end of the mRNA and generally the end of transcription. UTR is for untranslated region. This green region does not code for protein. Yeah. Okay, and at the boundaries of the exon, so at the 5' end of the exon, the upstream, the 5' end of the intron, the upstream portion of the intron, there is a signal called the 5' splice signal, and this is a representation of the sequences that you find there. So this representation is called a pictogram, and we align a bunch of exons to the splice junction, okay, to the boundary between the exon and the intron, look at the frequencies of the different nucleotides at the different positions. So these are the first two bases of the intron, the last base of the exon, et cetera. And in this representation, this means that you see G 100% of the time there, you see T 100% of the time there, you see A, say, 50% of the time, G 40%, and so forth. And so this just gives you a feeling for the nature of the signal. It's a somewhat degenerate or fuzzy signal. Many regulatory signals, or in this case, it's a constitutive signal, but signals related to transcription, splicing, and translation have this fuzzy character, which is actually quite interesting. And so I don't think you can read it, but the total amount of information in this signal in the relative entropy sense is about 8 to 9 bits. And similarly, at the 3' end of the intron, the downstream end, there's a signal in which you have a region rich in pyrimidines, T and C nucleotides, followed by a position, a pyrimidine, AG. And this signal also has about 8 or 9 bits, roughly 9 bits. And so that means that such signals will occur by chance about once every 250 to 500 bases. And in fact, in human transcripts, we do see such signals at roughly the frequency you'd expect. And the problem is that human transcripts are long, say 30 kb, maybe 10 exons, as I said before. So you get lots, so you have only, say, 9 true 5' splice sites, but you have many, many decoy 5' splice sites, which look, for all intents and purposes, just like the true ones. They match as well or better. Yes? This is a relative entropy relative to a background which is not 25-25.
Could there be splice information in the folding?
In the folding of the RNA? Yes. But most evidence suggests that that's not the most important contributor. It's sometimes important, but often not.
Using logo, normalize, make the type of the letter.
Yeah, that's so that's the Schneider representation. Yeah. For me, this is easier to read. I mean, yes.
It seems like you could get error bars in a high degree of letters with
right.
And so the question is, there seems to be in the 5' splice site, it's sort of interesting because it looks very specific, while at 3' it looks rather, at least in most of the links, rather general.
Right.
Are these fluctuations significant, or is it more that in this region?
We have very large data sets. This was based on 22,000 5' splice sites. So there's the error bars are very small. And in fact, it turns out there is a little bit more variability than I've shown. Sometimes you have a C here, and then there's a very rare class that has AT. I mean, but generally, their error bars are small. But there is a fundamental difference between this signal, where sort of each position has unique identity and meaning to the splicing machinery, whereas here, you sort of have this tract of pyrimidines, and in fact, sometimes it's further upstream, sometimes it's kind of variable position. And here we're just sort of seeing an average over many things. And so this may not be the best representation of this signal. Yes? Very good question. Okay, so first of all, we believe that the splicing is done with very high precision, say 99% accuracy or higher per intron, but it's very difficult to measure for a variety of reasons. However, if you think about it, a lot of genes, say a typical gene has 9 introns, and some genes have, say, 50 introns. And if you spliced each one with, say, 90% of the time correct, you would very rarely make the correctly spliced transcript, therefore very rarely make the correct protein. So it has to be, highly accurate. But we don't know. Well, I mean, the short answer to the specificity problem is that this is an active area of research. How does the splicing machinery splice with high accuracy, given that the signals are so degenerate? And
the splicing machinery universal, or do you have more
each organism has its own splicing machinery. Yeah. It's generally universal, although there may be subtle differences in the protein composition of spliceosomes for different introns. But this sort of, it's a core, there's a core machinery which is universal.
Are there hints of splicing through frequency?
There's something called the nonsense degradation pathway, where mRNAs that have, if you have make a splicing error that leads to a premature stop codon in the mRNA, then those mRNAs often, you don't even see them in the cytoplasm, they get degraded in the nucleus or in the cytoplasm. So that there is that's what. In addition, in the assembly of the spliceosome, there are proofreading steps. So there is some proofreading that goes on. But the short answer to the specificity question is that these signals are necessary but not sufficient for splicing. In some cases it may be sufficient, but in general you need additional signals either in the intron or in the exon. Yep.
Yeah, how much do you know about the spatial aspect?
You mean, say, that the length of the intron, the length of the exon, yes. These sorts of things? Yeah, in some cases that's important. I'll talk more about that in a moment. Yes?
To what extent do you know that the secondary structure of the
mRNA? In some cases it does. But there's it doesn't play as much of a role as you would think. There are experiments, say, introducing long regions of potential stem loop into mRNA, into pre-mRNAs to try to sequester a splice site, and often those don't have the predicted effect. So the idea is maybe the proteins in the nucleus, HNRMPs and other proteins, keep the primary transcript more or less single-stranded, something like that. But in some cases it does matter, so it's complicated. Okay. So I like to think of these problems related to the exon-intron structure of genes in terms of molecular codes. So we're all familiar with the genetic code, which is a set of rules for how a given mRNA sequence, what protein it encodes. There's also, one can think of a gene finding code, which, given the genomic DNA of an organism, would tell you where all the genes are. And I'll talk a little bit more about our attempts to solve this problem in a moment. And then there's also the RNA splicing code. So we'd like, for any given arbitrary pre-mRNA sequence, we'd like to know how would the splicing machinery pick the exons and introns and what mRNA would be produced. And we're actively working on this problem also. So I just want to briefly review. Now again, this is somewhat old hat, but just sort of sets the background. So GenScan, the basic idea is to make a model of what a human gene looks like in general in terms of its exon intron structure and sequence composition. And then in principle, given an input sequence, we assign a probability to every possible gene structure which is compatible with that sequence. And then, of course, this would be an exponential number of gene structures. We can't actually evaluate all of them. So in practice, you use a dynamic programming algorithm to determine the most probable gene structure. Yes?
When you show the statistics for slide types and things like that, is there a qualitative difference or a observable difference when you have, definitive splice site versus a splice site that's an alternative splice site that's sometimes used and sometimes not used?
We're looking at that. There isn't a lot of published work on that issue, but in general, the consensus is that alternatively spliced exons have weak splice signals. But there are examples where they don't, so it's not, more complicated. We don't know that. We don't know that. I mean, there are many theories. One theory is it gives you the possibility to make different mRNAs, therefore different proteins from the same gene by alternative splicing.
You can.
It turns out it's quite common. In human genes, perhaps half of all human genes may be alternatively spliced. Some of that is likely to be very important. Others, it's just sort of maybe noise of the splicing machinery, which is irrelevant. Say it makes two equivalent proteins. So that may or may not be the reason why we have introns in the first place. There could be other advantages, but that's a whole other topic, and it's more speculative. I made a mistake there, so I'm just going to try to go by memory, because I don't know how to go back in PowerPoint. page up? Okay. All right. This should be... Okay. Thank you. It's about my third PowerPoint presentation. So GenScan is a semi-Markov HMM model of human gene structure, and I'll I'll explain what this means later in a moment. Mostly it models the hexamer composition of exons and introns. So it turns out that exons and introns have very different composition in terms of base composition, triplet composition, hexamer composition, and so forth. And this is a very useful signal for distinguishing exons from introns. It's a fifth order Markov model, so it's capturing the hexamer composition, and that is capturing lower order things. We believe there are dependencies, even longer dependencies in sequences, but we don't really have enough data to do this, eighth order Markov or something like that. It also uses the extended 5' and 3' splice signals that I showed, and it enforces things like the reading frame consistency of exons, that is, the exons, when they splice together, have to make a contiguous open reading frame to be translated. It incorporates exon intron length distributions, which I'll come to in a moment, and the promoter and polyadenylation signals, and some differences between different regions of the genome, regions of high GC content and low GC, where gene structure is quite different. And I put these in green because these are of lesser importance. These are the two major contributors to the accuracy of these methods.
Is polyadenylation in the original DNA genome, or is it added on?
The signal is in the DNA sequence, which then gets transcribed to RNA, and then factors recognize that signal, and then they cut the RNA, and then add the A's, the actual stretch, the polyadenylation, the string of A's is actually added in the RNA, but it's not coded in the genome. Okay, does that make sense? Yeah. Okay, so this is just a diagram of the model that's used. So we have these states. Each state represents a component of a gene. So for instance, intergenic region between genes, promoter of a gene on the forward strand. So genes can go on either DNA strand. We have a UTR region, untranslated. We have states that represent exons, the first exon of a gene, introns. And here we keep track of the intron phase, which I'll come to in a moment, where the intron breaks a codon. And then we have you can have a variable number of internal exons, terminal exon, untranslated region, poly-A signal, and so forth. And then you could also have the same thing for a gene on the opposite strand, okay, except you'd encounter these signals in the opposite order.
Circles and diamonds are
just right to the eye? There is a difference between the circles and diamonds. The circles are basically exons, regions where we use a general model of length. And for the diamonds, we use a sort of an HMM, a geometric length distribution. So there's a difference, but I'll come to that in a moment. Okay. So the point about this model is that it can represent sort of the parse or the a grammar of a region. This region has one gene, it's got five exons, and so forth. And it can represent fragments of genes or multiple genes per sequence, et cetera. So it's fairly general. It's not completely general. It can't represent genes which overlap each other, because every pair of adjacent genes has to have an intergenic region in between. It also can't represent alternative splicing, so where you have you either use this exon or that exon. That's not included in this model. So again, just to review structure of a human gene. I don't think I need anything more. And this is just a review of some of the types of models that are used in sequence analysis and specifically in gene finding. So we all know about Markov chains, in which state n plus 1 depends on state n, but not on the previous history of the process. And then a hidden Markov model is where you have a hidden Markov chain, which then generates observable data. So for instance, these circles might represent the coding or non-coding state of the sequence, and then the they would perhaps generate nucleotides according to, or say DNA triplets according to the biases that are characteristic of coding or non-coding DNA. And then you would, the HMM problem is to go from the observables to infer what was the most likely sequence of hidden states. And such a model, a simple model just with coding and non-coding, was used in early by Anders Krogh to model bacterial genes. So the problem with that sort of model for human genes, one problem is that if you had just had a coding state which could recur to itself, then the lengths of stretches of contiguous coding states would have this geometric distribution, okay? And that's just a property of HMMs. Whereas the real lengths of human exons shown here for internal exons, that is exons flanked by introns, initial exons and terminal exons, have length distributions which are not geometric at all. And so we'd like to be able to model this length distribution. And
geometric
it's just the discrete version of exponential, right? There's a lot of evidence that exon length in particular is important for the function of a gene. So so most human exons are sort of in the 1 to 200 base range, and mutations which delete them to smaller than about 50 often lead to them being skipped by the splicing machinery. And mutations which make them bigger than about 300 also often lead to splicing defects. So we think that the splicing machinery recognizes exons and that there's an optimal length. And so that's an important property of a gene that we want to be able to model. And an HMM framework doesn't conveniently model that property. However, introns have a more or less geometric or exponential length distribution. This is old data, so actually, I mean, they're bigger now. Introns have gotten bigger over time.
The splicing machinery recognizes
exons. I'll come to that later. Yeah. Sorry. This is for human. This is for human. It's not. It's similar in other vertebrates, but in invertebrates, it's very different. This is actually relatively common, although you know the mean shifts with the intron density of the organism clearly. But the mode, I mean, that's something from the Nature Human Genome paper, is that the mode of the exon length distribution is similar between human Drosophila and C. elegans, even though the mean is different and the intron lengths are very different. So,
in all cases, there's a dip at a short
exon. In all cases, yeah, there are not that many short exons. That's probably a general. I think that's general. Yeah, but there are big differences when you go, say, compare human to yeast to C. elegans or something.
Do you think that the picture for intron length distribution is accurate because the minimum length of intron is something that exists?
Right. There's a minimum length, perhaps 60, 65 bases. That's one issue. I mean, that on this scale, you don't even see that. This is like 0 to 100 is one bin or something, so you can't even see that.
But when you talk about geometric distribution, it will be a little bit.
Yeah, it's geometric, but with a minimum that's not one. It's not exactly. Yeah. Yes?
Question. The tail of the distribution, how significantly overrepresented are longer introns than you would expect with a geometric distribution? I'm just wondering if you blow up the tail region there, it's significant non-geometric.
I haven't looked at that. It's an interesting question. One problem is that the data gets, because we're limited in terms of the amount of contiguous genomic sequence we have, even now, you know, because the data is in this rough draft, sort of long introns are systematically underrepresented in our data set. And so you really need long, you need to look at that in long contiguous regions where you have full-length cDNA, so you know the exon intron structure. And it hasn't, as far as I know, maybe Phil Green has looked at this, but nobody's really looked at that as far as I know.
Wood.
Yes.
Wood.
Has looked at the tail of the intron length distribution to see if it is geometric or if there's a bias, if there's more than you expect or something like that. But yeah, I mean, there's also the C plus G composition of the gene has a big effect on intron length, maybe a factor of 10 difference in mean intron length between high and low G plus C. So it's not a homogeneous population. It's complicated. So, to model more accurately model these length distributions, we used what's called a semi-Markov model. Other people have other names for this. This is a name that was used in the 70s in the electrical engineering community. And basically, you have the states follow each other according to a Markov chain, but then each has an associated length, okay, which can come from an arbitrary distribution, which could depend on the type of state. Okay, so this might be, say, an exon state. It would then generate some length. Or it would be an intron state. It would have some other length distribution and so forth. And then a hidden semi-Markov would be where from this length you would then generate a corresponding amount of of DNA sequence. Okay. David Hausler calls these kind of models generalized HMM models, and there are other names like explicit state duration HMM, and so forth. So in our model, the state is actually quite complicated. It's got a length associated with it, and then it's got some internal structure. So for instance, an internal exon, that is an exon flanked by introns, would have a branch 3' splice signal region. That's the signal I showed before, a coding region, and then a 5' splice signal region. And then the intron would say start be homogeneous in this model. This is just okay. So in the GenScan model, we model the splice signals using models that I won't describe. But anyway, they capture these sorts of biases as well as certain dependencies that occur between positions in these signals. And then we also model the composition of exons and introns. So exons, it's long been known, have a distinctive composition at each of the three codon positions. Okay, so coding exons are coded in a certain reading frame, and so that means that this triplet is read as a codon, this triplet, and so forth. And so the nucleotides you see at the position one of codons have a different composition than position two and position three. And one way to model this, and then also higher order patterns, pentamers, hexamers, et cetera, have a different composition depending on which frame they're in, which phase they're in. And so one way to model this, which was actually pioneered by Mark Borodovsky, is a three-periodic Markov chain. So in this model, you have a fifth-order Markov model, which determines the probability of the next nucleotide conditional on the previous five and conditional that you're generating the first nucleotide of the codon. Okay, and you have a similar fifth-order Markov model for the second base and the third base, and then you go back and use the same model again. Okay. And for non-coding regions, we use just a homogeneous fifth-order Markov model. Okay. So I'm not going to go into this in detail, but the model specifies a probability for any given parse. We use phi to represent the parse that is the set of exon intron structure of the genes in a region. It determines the joint probability of any particular parse and the sequence that you're given. And then to find the optimal parse of the sequence, you define variables which store the probability of the optimal parse up to a given position in the sequence, and then solve recursively. And you can also do forward-backward algorithms to calculate other things like the probability of a set of parses or something.
A state like exon intron, you also distinguish the 5' untranslated exon with the coding intron.
Yeah, there's a state for a 5' untranslated region. The one thing we don't model is introns that occur in the untranslated regions. We don't think we can predict those very accurately, and so we kind of ignore that. So there's just, does that make sense?
Well, once you model this arbitrary distribution of exponents, how do you look
at the dynamic? Yeah, coming to that, good question. Okay. So in a standard HMM, you do this Viterbi algorithm by basically for each state maximizing. So these are the different states of your model. Say there are five states. These are the different positions in the sequence. And say going from position I to position I plus one, at this state you maximize over the inputs from the previous five states. Okay, and so the full set of transitions you have to look at from going from one position to the next is shown here, and therefore, it's quadratic in the number of states and linear in the length of the sequence. Okay, but for a model in which you have more general length dependence, such as the semi-Markov HMM model shown here, where you have a Markov chain, but then, so that's an HMM, and then you have, in a semi-Markov, a length that's associated with each state, from which you generate the sequence, you need to use a more complicated version of the Viterbi algorithm. So in general, you actually, from going from position I to position I plus one, you have to look back, the entire length of the sequence to find all the possible exons and introns that might transition to this state. And so in general, it's L cubed, which is very, very bad for bioinformatics because L here could be, you know, 100,000, a million, you know, something like that. And so it's totally impractical. But with sort of some pre-computation steps and some tricks, you can make it faster. And the main trick that we use in GenScan is we use geometric length distributions for essentially reverting it to the HMM case for the introns, intergenic regions, and 5' UTRs, which are the regions which can be quite long. The exons, as I mentioned, are generally short. And also, we enforce reading frame constraints. So an exon has to have an open reading frame through it that has no stop codons. Open reading frames, by chance, are only about 20 codons long. And so you only have to look back. So say you're at a potential you're at a potential 5' splice site, the end of an exon. Okay, you only have to look back until you hit stop codons in all three frames. And once you hit that, you know that the exon can't begin anywhere before that. And so effectively, that limits the search space. You don't have to look back arbitrarily far. And effectively, the algorithm is linear in the number of potential exons in a sequence. And it turns out the number of potential exons grows linearly with sequence, and as you might expect. Okay, but if you have a region which has no stop codons and is a million bases long, the algorithm will be very, very slow. But those don't generally occur. So how well does this program work? In our own tests, on regions containing single human genes, it gets about 70 to 80% of the exons correct, in terms of both having both boundaries correct. And on larger regions of the genome, it doesn't do quite as well, but still seems to do reasonably well. So when the first human chromosome, chromosome 22, was sequenced, GenScan and other methods were used to try to find the genes, and they compared the predictions to the annotated genes, that is, genes for which the evidence was considered compelling, reliable, known genes. And it predicted 94% of them, at least partially, that is at least some of the exons right, therefore missed about 6% of genes. We actually think it misses a little bit fewer than this. But anyway, roughly, you know, a few percent of genes are missed. And for the annotated exons, about 84% were predicted at least partially, therefore about 16% were missed. And but one of the interesting things was that it seems to predict a lot more exons than are actually there.
Yeah.
Well, it predicts the exact, you know, the exact coordinates of exons. Well, so in our tests, for 70 to 80% of exons, you get the exact coordinates right. Okay, and similarly with maybe 70% of introns, you know, the coordinates both are correct. Therefore, the exons will be fused correctly and generate the correct amino acid sequence. But it's actually not independent, so it's a little bit higher, but. But yeah, so if you look at the amino acid level, I mean, there are different ways to measure the accuracy, but we usually get, you know, most of the gene is predicted mostly correct, you know, or, I mean, in some cases you get, you know, there's a gene with 10 exons and you get them all, and in other cases, 10 exons and you get, you know, six of them or something like that.
Was information from chromosome 22 used for such parameters?
No. So, anyway, so it doesn't seem to miss very many genes, but it seems to perhaps overpredict, and that's a question: is how
much of a complication you mentioned? Sort of best set was referred as RefSeq.
Yeah, the RefSeq is a database of full-length cDNA sequences.
Was it also used as best set? Get some any updated figures for
that? We've done those, but I don't remember the numbers.
When you say 84% predict partially, it means
that
you don't get.
So I think that means like you got one of the splice sites, but not necessarily both. One boundary. Perhaps, yeah. I mean, at least partially. I mean, in most cases, when it gets an exon, it gets both boundaries correct. But sometimes it'll get one of the boundaries wrong.
In case of missing, do you miss concurrently the terminal exon?
Yeah, the accuracy.
How you pass exons correctly into different genes, do you tend to pass terminal epsilon as internal epsilon or what?
Yeah, these are good questions. So first of all, the accuracy is highest for internal exons that are flanked by introns, and is lowest for initial exons, first exon of the gene, and is kind of intermediate for terminal exons. We have data on that. And another effect is that short exons are more likely to be missed, as you might expect. I mean, they have the same splice sequence signal, but have less coding signal. And also, the program is not very good at getting gene boundaries, so sometimes it fuses two genes together or breaks them apart. I'll show some examples of that in a moment. It's very hard to measure because we don't really have very good data sets of large genomic regions where all the genes have been parsed correctly or annotated correctly. But it happens 20% of the time. I don't know. It's not very good at getting the boundaries. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, typically, so we don't actually enumerate all the, all the possible parses. We thought about that, but the problem is that typically, the region is big, say 200 kilobases long. It may have, 37 predicted exons, and the next best solution, would be just, deleting one of those. It would be, just a trivial change from the best solution. That makes sense in terms of the parse. But we've also implemented what we call suboptimal exons, which is where you evaluate the probability of each possible exon using the forward-backward algorithm to sum over the probabilities of all the parses that go through the exon. And then we print out all the suboptimal exons which have probability greater than a certain threshold. And in general, there are some additional suboptimal exons, and sometimes those are correct, sometimes they're wrong, sometimes they're alternative spliced exons or something like that.
Yeah. And the question which was asked about suboptimal classes of the global
right.
scale, just in a little bit different direction, would it have any implications for alternative splicing? For instance, we see the first best solution, but you might think that the second best might.
You might think that, say, if the gene is not alternatively spliced, if it's always spliced in one way, then the best solution would be much higher than all the other solutions. But if it's alternatively spliced, maybe you'd have a second best solution, which was close in probability to the best one, something like that. That's certainly worth exploring, but we believe you have to get pretty close, very close to the answer before you can even, start to make those. It's a little too subtle for, I think, the current generation of models. Although sometimes it works. I mean, sometimes here's the predicted gene, and then it's got one known alternative splice, and you ask, what is the best suboptimal exon? It's that additional exon, and then it works. But sometimes, the prediction is only got 10 out of 15 exons right, and then the suboptimal prediction, adds another two wrong exons. We're not quite at the level where we can really make those predictions accurately. Terry. Our training set was relatively small. It was between 300 and 400. Genes sequenced at both genomic and cDNA level, plus about 1,600 cDNAs to get the parameters for the coding fifth order Markov models. So it was a few million bases of DNA. Yeah, it was about a few million bases of intron and intragenic, right? And a few million bases of coding. Where certainly with larger data sets, you can do. We've retrained it with larger data sets, but we don't see much of a difference. Yes. Yeah, we've looked at that a little bit. The model, all the vertebrates are roughly the same. The human model works as well on human as on mouse. It doesn't work quite as well on fly. It's terrible on C. elegans, on worm. But with a few little tweaks, it works okay on plants. And, we were surprised at how general it was. That is, I mean, Drosophila genes have quite different gene structure, and yet the model works, basically as well in Drosophila as human. But then other organisms, it doesn't. So there's, we're involved, actually, we're currently, retraining it for a bunch of different organisms. but I don't have the data with me. Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, so the default prediction is just the optimal parse, the optimal complete gene structure of the sequence. Okay. But then, if you want to look at suboptimal things, you know, near the optimal, then we just look at, rather than suboptimal parses, which tend to be too subtle, okay, to be interesting, we look at suboptimal exons. So you go back, evaluate each individual potential exon. Then, if it's found in the optimal parse, don't print it, okay, because you already got it. But if it's has probability greater than, you know, 0.5 or something, but is not in the optimal parse, print it out.
So these numbers are the alpha, the most probable.
This is just the most probable parse, right? If you look at the suboptimal ones, you know, you find a few more exons, a few more genes, and all. Right.
If you look at the posterior probabilities, how does that correlate with the probability of
the next? Yeah, that's a good question, and we have looked at that, and correlates pretty well. But it's sort of, the posterior probability seems to be a little bit too high, generally. So if you look at the ones that are, say, have a posterior probability between 0.95 and 1, maybe 90% of those are correct, or something like that. It's a pretty good, you know, whereas the ones that are, say, between 0.5 and 0.7, maybe only 50% of those are correct. You know, so it's a pretty good correlation, but it's not exact.
So, yeah. So for exon passing into different genes, you use the promoter identification?
Yeah, but we have a very, very simple model, which is not very good. And that doesn't really... That's one weakness of the model, is we're not very good at modeling the promoter or the polyadenylation signal, because these are really complicated signals in human. But we're open to, if someone has a better model, to incorporating that, or, yeah, et cetera. So if you have a better model, let me know. Yeah. The transcription start sites predicted by GenScan are not at all accurate. I don't have any confidence in them. Yeah. Okay. The exons, if you've got a pair of exons with high probability, it's worth a look. It's worth perhaps doing an experiment, you know, especially if they're internal exons. And I'll show you that in a moment. But for the transcription start and stop sites, it's not accurate. Okay, so this is just a summary in terms a different way of looking at the chromosome 22 data from the Sanger Center paper. So there were 247 genes I considered known as a full-length cDNA was known, 150 that were related, 148 that were predicted genes, which had some ESTs, which are fragments of cDNAs, and suggesting that they were genes, but not proving it, about 134 pseudogenes, and then there were an additional 325 genes that were predicted by GenScan, but were not similar to any known gene, protein, or EST sequence. And so the question was, how many of these genes are real? So as I said, it got about 90-something percent of these genes up here, but then it predicts a very large number of additional genes.
What a pseudogene is?
A pseudogene is a dead gene, so it's derived from a copy of a gene, but then it's acquired some mutation which has made it non-functional. Say not transcribed anymore or something, or some other defect. Okay. Well, the most common family of pseudogenes are processed pseudogenes, so it's actually reverse transcribed mRNA, which has been inserted into the genome somewhere, and sometimes it's truncated, or has a premature stop, or not transcribed. Usually they have stops. So that was about a year ago when the chromosome 22 paper was published, and so we were interested in this question of how many of these predicted novel genes are these just, prediction artifacts, or are these additional, poorly expressed genes which just haven't shown up in the standard gene detection methods? And so we undertook a collaboration with Jerry Pelletier at McGill to test these. And so what we did was take predicted genes, take a pair of adjacent exons. Here's a predicted exon, another predicted exon from a gene which is predicted but not similar to anything that's known, and then determine a PCR primer in this exon and one in this exon, so that the product you would get from the mRNA would be of one length, and the product from the genomic would be of another length. People know what PCR is. Does this experiment make sense? Okay. So And this is a sample of our data. This work is submitted, so hopefully it will be published someday. And these are different predicted genes where we got a single clear band that was dependent on the presence of the reverse transcriptase, which shows that it's coming from RNA and not DNA. So there's a problem when the idea is you purify RNA from the cell, so mRNA from the cell, but there could be contamination with DNA, and so you need to make sure it's dependent on the reverse transcriptase enzyme, which takes the RNA and converts it back to DNA. Okay. So anyway, so these are bands where the, clearly the gene is real, and then we cut out these bands and sequence them to confirm that it is the right product. And this is just a picture. So here, without RT, you don't see a band, and with RT, you do see a band. These up here, yeah. These are in some cases we didn't see a band, but I'm not showing those. All these have a band. It's just that it didn't show up on the PowerPoint. Yeah, it's very faint. Yeah. If you don't see a band, you can't infer that the gene is not real because we looked at I said I should have mentioned this 18 tissues, and there are a lot more tissues than that in the human body, and so they could be expressed in some other tissue that we didn't look at. So when you see a band that's of the correct size and sequence, the strong evidence that the gene it is an expressed gene. When you don't see a band, you can't really infer anything other than that it's probably not expressed in those tissues. Okay. And so these are the tissues that we used in a variety, just sort of a random collection, or trying to be a diverse collection of human tissues. And this just shows that the expression pattern of some of our predicted genes, which turned out to be real, and most of them actually were only expressed in one or a few tissues, and at very apparently at very low levels. So that's probably why they didn't end up in EST databases. But a few of them were expressed in a more diverse collection of tissues, such as these shown here. And based on our data, we can also say something about which tissues sort of have the most novel genes in them. And we think that, yeah, you could do that in principle. We haven't done that. There's also an issue of we have a pair of predicate exons that's that's here on the chromosome. You probably can't see it. Anyway, so here on the chromosome, there's to say a known gene over here, and we can't say for sure that this is a different gene. It could be additional exons of that gene which they didn't annotate or something. So it's tough to, we still have a problem with gene boundaries. And the only way to really do that is to, like you suggested, long range PCR or better, full length cDNA cloning. So anyway, based on this, we can assess which tissues are most likely to have a bunch of novel genes. And it looks like the testis is a very rich source of novel genes. And I think fetal brain and fetal lung also. This is just a summary of this experiment. We had roughly 1,100 predicted genes in chromosome 22. Actually, we mask it less than the Sanger people did, so we get a little bit different number. About 600 matched annotated genes. 500 didn't, and then we randomly chose 230 to be targeted by our RT-PCR strategy. This is a summary of the results. So in about slightly less than half, we got no PCR product. In about a quarter, we got multiple bands or a non-specific band, that is the wrong sequence. And in 62 cases, about 30% of the time, we got a specific product, which is the correct size and sequence. Okay. So we confirm that. Perhaps 30% or more of our predicted genes are real. So there certainly are additional real genes on chromosome 22. So should we take a break, or there isn't really time to take a break? Right. No, I'm not tired, but could you get me some more water? I'm just a little bit dry. Thanks.
Okay, maybe we should keep going.
Okay. Yeah, I'll just keep going. So there are. What I've been telling you about is GenScan, which is an example of an ab initio gene prediction program where you try to model what a gene looks like in general in terms of exon interest structure and composition. There are many other ab initio gene predictors, including HMM gene, Anders Crow, Grail, Genlang, Phil Green's gene finder, and there are maybe a dozen others. There are also other widely used methods for inferring genes. One example is GeneWise, which uses sort of an alignment of the protein sequence to translated bits of the DNA sequence using homology. And there are new methods which use homology between genomic sequences using the fact that exons are more conserved than introns, such as the ExoFish method, which compares human genomic to fish genomic, and the Glass-Rosetta approach, which uses human-mouse alignments to help identify genes. So there are a whole variety of methods. And then there's also our algorithm genome scan, which we call a gene inference method because it combines elements of ab initio prediction with homology information. And I'll talk about that in a moment. There are also some new high-throughput experimental approaches to identifying genes, including the full-length cDNA sequencing efforts being done in Japan, the RIKEN Consortium, and also microarray methods, such as the work being done by Rosetta. So I'll show that here briefly. In this approach, you take predicted exons along, say, chromosome 22 in this case. So here's one predicted exon, the next. Design 60 base probes to those predicted exons and array them in order as they occur along the chromosome. And then you hybridize those probes to RNA from, in this case, 69 different pairs of tissues. And then you look for sets of adjacent predicted exon probes which go up and down. So the green indicates underexpression, red overexpression in one tissue versus another. And you look for sets of predicted exons which go up and down together and infer that that is a gene. You're using the fact that the exons of a gene should be perfectly co-expressed with each other. Okay. They're not perfectly co-expressed in this experiment, and that's due to experimental error, presumably. So this is a known gene. And then the white bar here is the boundary which their clustering algorithm decides is the boundary of a gene. So this next predicted exon is predicted not to be in that same gene. Does that make sense? So it's you array the predicted exons, hybridize them to a bunch of tissues, then use correlation to identify adjacent correlated exons. And here's another example of a novel gene where it's only expressed actually in two tissues, and so these are the two where it's found. And then this work was described in the genome issue of Nature fairly recently. And then I have a News and Views in Nature Genetics, which talks about this. Yeah, it's a DNA microarray, inkjet printing. They put all predicted and annotated exons from chromosome 22, about 8,000 exons, onto one microarray together with appropriate controls. I'm just showing a sample of that. Well, it's a sample of that data. Okay. They had one microarray, 8,000 exons plus a bunch of control probes. They hybridized it to 69 different pairs of cDNA samples. So one microarray, 69 different copies of it. Okay, and then they took that data and did this clustering analysis to call the genes.
So in the bottom protein, it would be expressed at some level everywhere in order to have an underexpression.
So these are actually pairs. I don't really want to get into the detail, but they're pairs of tissues, and it's in both cases this represents expression in testis and not in the other tissue. It's just they label one, the way they label the two. And, let's not get into that. But there is quite a bit of noise in the method. I think a lot of those spots are just noise. So this is a summary of what they found. As I said, they tested every predicted and annotated exon in chromosome 22. And by their method, they call expression verified genes, those that are called by their clustering algorithm to be genes. And 85% of the known genes, they detected them by their method. So if the gene is expressed at a completely constant level across tissues, by their method, they actually don't detect it efficiently. So they don't have 100% sensitivity. But they did get evidence for about 57% of the ab initio predicted genes. These are the additional genes predicted by GenScan, which are not similar to anything. And so I just want to compare this to our data with RT-PCR. We did a control where we tested with our RT-PCR method 30 known genes on chromosome 22, and we detected 100% of them by RT-PCR. So we have higher sensitivity, but we only got evidence for 30% of them based on this. So we perhaps have lower, we have higher, whatever it is. we only get evidence for 30%, but we only looked at 18 tissues. They looked at 69 tissues, so that could be the difference. I'm sorry? Just the first chromosome to be sequenced. It's treated as sort of a representative piece of the genome, although it's a little bit more gene dense, actually, than a typical one. About 1% of the genome. So another method is ExoFISH, which involves comparison of human genomic DNA to that of the pufferfish, Tetraodon. And this is a very interesting approach and has been used by a group at Genoscope in France. It has a small genome, about 400 megabases, compared to the human is 3,000, and most other vertebrates are also very large. And it has very low repeat content. It's almost very clean genome, so it's ideal for exon-intron finding type stuff. It's also at a good distance from human, where you don't get much that's conserved in non-coding regions. Almost everything that's conserved is coding. So when you have a genomic sequence and you want to know what's in it in terms of genes, you often have a lot of extrinsic information. That is, you can blast the sequence against known cDNAs or ESTs, find regions of homology or identity. You can also translate the genomic sequence in the different reading frames, blast that against a protein database, so that's a program called BlastX, and find regions of identity or similarity. And then, of course, you can run an ab initio gene prediction program such as GenScan to find regions, which uses the fact that certain regions sort of look like an exon in terms of their hexamer composition or have possible splice signals. And so an idea which has been explored by several authors, including ourselves, is to combine these two into one algorithm. So we developed a new method called GenomeScan, which combines probabilistic extrinsic information, such as blast hits, with a probabilistic model of the GenScan model of gene structure and composition. And our goal was to make the method efficient and reliable enough that we could run it on an entire vertebrate genome, such as a human genome, without human supervision. So you just set up to run it, and you run it on 100,000 sequences, and it doesn't crash. And this is not a totally trivial thing. And then we also wanted to make it to focus on the typical case when we have, say, a moderately similar protein, but not the identical protein. If you've got the identical protein, that's a different sort of a trivial problem or relatively easy problem, and there are other methods for that. And so we wanted to sort of do this sort of intermediate case. If you have a very weakly similar protein or no similar protein is known, you might as well just use GenScan. And if you've got, so that we're going for the sort of intermediate case, which is also the most common. And I'm not going to go into the technical details of this method, but if anyone wants to talk about it later. But the basic idea of GenScan is that you have a model of sort of a structure model, which you can think of as a prior on gene structures, in which most of the parses have roughly similar probabilities. They differ a little bit because of the dependence on the lengths and so forth, but roughly they have sort of order of magnitude comparable probabilities. But then when you use the sequence generating part of the model, then some of them have much higher probabilities than others. And so really, most of the prediction is coming from your models of the exon-intron sequence and splice signal sequence. And then you use this to identify the most probable gene structure. So in GenomeScan, what we do, by contrast, is we start, again, with these, you can think of these prior structural probabilities of these parses. Then we have extrinsic information, such as the presence of a BLAST-X hit. So this is a region of similarity of, say, this region translated to a known protein, and we use that to bias these prior probabilities to make the probabilities of parses which are consistent with that information higher than the probabilities of those which are inconsistent lower. But we treat the information probabilistically. We don't require that the parse be consistent with this information, because not all the similarity information is correct. For instance, in the case of a pseudogene, you would have a region of sequence similarity, but it wouldn't really, the inference that that's a gene wouldn't necessarily be correct. So this is sort of doesn't really describe it in enough detail to be, so that you can implement it. But and there are a number of problems with this. In fact, our first versions of genome scan were less accurate than GenScan, which was very disappointing. And one of the problems that we ran across was that when you look at BLAST-X hits, so regions of, say, translated genomic DNA shown here in blue with aligned to known proteins, then you have often BLAST-X goes too far. So here, in this case, the exon extends from here to roughly here, and then this region here is just sort of tacked on by BLAST, but is not correct. It's actually aligning a portion of the intron of the genomic region to the protein. And so this causes problems. If you require that the parse contain this entire region, then you will force the program to predict a wrong splice site at this boundary and so forth. And we found that overall that actually made the algorithm worse. And so what we do is to post-process the BLAST hits using a steepest slope heuristic. So you can think of these scores between similar amino acids. You can accumulate them along the sequence. You get some kind of distribution, and the BLAST hits correspond to upward excursions of this on the score plot. And what we do is we look at the shape of that score plot. We find the region of steepest slope over a window of 15 codons, and we say this is the region most likely to be internal to the exon. And so, and then we just require that parses to be consistent with that information have to go through that region in the correct reading frame. Is that clear? Is there chalk? I could do this with chalk. Anyway, you get this score plot. So in this case, in this alignment, it might look like this, but this is kind of the weak region at the end, and this region is much stronger. The scores are going higher. These are the similarity scores. And we would calculate the slope and say, okay, this is the region of steepest slope. So we just require that the exon contain that point, that base, in the appropriate reading frame. This, and then we let, yes?
I was just thinking the incorrectly aligned part might also have a better match downstream in the two exons.
Yeah.
You look for that.
Yeah, we also use that information too. So the way we use that is we look for pairs. If you have a pair of regions of the genomic sequence which align to adjacent regions of proteins. So this is now protein. This is protein here. I realize it's hard to read. If you have a pair of regions like this that align, then we downweight any exon that's in between here in the genomic sequence. So yeah, we also use that. Yes, Terry. We use a 15 codon window. So, yeah, that's somewhat arbitrary, but virtually all exons are larger than 15 codons, and so it's reasonable. And if there are a bunch of heuristics which we came up with which help the performance. And I mean, it's not really that clean of a problem. The BLOSSOM scores, say the scores that BLAST is using. BLOSSOM, yeah, the BLOSSOM matrix, the similarity matrix. Whatever score, yeah.
But why do you think it's slow?
That's the region that sort of looks, has the strongest similarity. I mean, the idea is that the real regions have stronger similarity than the sort of introns, which are aligning to proteins.
I think the scores are important, right? So the types of scores. Like in BLAST, you measure scores. You don't measure the derivative ones.
I'm talking about the BLOSSOM scores, yeah.
The BLOSSOM scores, they are
right.
Similarity scores.
Right. Right, so we're looking for the region
they
which has highest...
Scores.
Right, they're logout scores. We're looking for the region of highest similarity.
Yes. Yes, but
that's
this
right.
Is on the top of the mountain, not on the slope.
No. No, so this is a cumulative score plot. Yeah, maybe I didn't. Yeah, maybe I didn't. Yeah, there's a cumulative score plot. So the predicted, the region output by BLAST is from the start of the excursion to the top, right, and then it starts going down here. And the cumulative score problem. Okay. So so the other heuristic I mentioned was the if you have adjacent regions of the protein hitting different parts of the genome, then you can infer that there aren't exons in between there. There's another heuristic we use where if the hit to the protein, say this is the beginning of the protein, and it hits, right here in the genomic, and this is, say, within a small number of codons, say 30 codons or so, then we can, and there's a methionine, say, here in the genomic, then we can infer that this may be the initial methionine. So you can use the information to help find the beginnings of genes and also the ends of genes and so forth. So there's several heuristics which are used to make this better. But I think that the way that we're incorporating the probabilistic information is fairly general and fairly clean. But then in order to get it to work, you need to use a variety of heuristics. So this is an example of a region of the human genome containing the breast cancer gene, BRCA1, where people at the Sanger Center who sequenced this region told me, GenScan does lousy in this region. And so let's take a look. So in this representation, the known genes are shown in black, okay? So this is, say, the first exon of a gene, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, okay? And these are connected by introns here. So these lines represent the sequence. It's about 117,000 bases long. And genes on the forward strand go this way. Genes on the opposite strand go that way. So these are the known gene structures. These are the predicted in orange, the GenScan predicted exon. So here's first exon predicted, second, third, fourth, fifth. And then what you see here in green are the regions of BLASTx similarity to known mouse proteins. Okay, so regions of this genomic sequence, which when you translate them, are similar to a known mouse protein. In this case, there are homologs of all these genes in mouse, and so you're getting hits. And notice that the hits are mostly to the exons, although there's some hits that are to other regions, which are sort of false, false BLASTx hits. And there are more false BLASTx hits than you would think in our experience. And what you see here is that GenScan does a fairly lousy job on BRCA. It actually misses the first five exons, gets the sixth correct, and misses the seventh and eighth, predicts an extra intron in this exon, and so forth. And it does better down toward the end of the gene. And then it does reasonably well on these three genes here. But when you give genome scan this additional information of these BLAST hits here, shown in green, and the genome scan prediction shown in red, you can see it's basically perfect for the BRCA gene and very good also for the other genes. And it's not surprising, you tell it, okay, there's a BLASTx hit here, 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 and here. It's not surprising that it's now able to get those exons. But a particularly interesting case is this exon here, where it's a very small exon, too small to give a significant BLASTx hit. And there's no similarity, but there is similarity to the next exon, exon 8. And so using this information, that forced genome scan to predict this exon, and then this one is not compatible in terms of reading frame with this one here. And so it was forced to find something else in between, and it got the right thing. So this is an example of an exon which was sort of considered by the GenScan model, but was suboptimal and not good enough, and then, but it's now forced in order to create a translatable local reading frame. Okay, so occasionally the program exhibits these sort of rudimentary signs of intelligence. And here's another example, a more complicated region with more genes. And this is somewhat typical, I would say, of running GenScan on a gene-dense region of the human genome, where you get a prediction here, which is quite good, get a prediction here where the boundaries are off, the start and end of the gene are not very good, and here also the start is not very good. You get a couple extra predicted genes, which don't seem to be correct. Here you fuse two genes together, but then here you do reasonably well. And then this is a prediction which does not map to a known gene. So is that clear? This is kind of gives you a feeling for the level of accuracy. You kind of get the rough, structure of the genes, but sometimes you do bad things like fuse genes together. Okay. Yeah. Again, I'm using a mouse similarity to known mouse proteins. So we have. I'm going to show some data on that in a moment. So what you see is that these green hits, the blast X hits, are helping you. In this case, they just sort of confirm the structure that was already predicted. In this case, they help. I'm sorry, there are no hits here, so you don't get any corrective information to correct this this gene boundary. But here, there is some strong similarity here, which now is near the very beginning of this protein and helps genome scan to know that this is the beginning of a gene. So that gets this one correct, and then that has a consequence that it helps genome scan get the beginning of this gene correct also. And you can see it's overall significantly better. And then it doesn't predict these genes anymore. The default version of genome scan is only predict genes which have at least a little bit of similarity to something. That's the way the default is. I mean, if you don't use that, then it'll sort of default to gen scan behavior, and then we already have gen scan for that. So.
It's interesting that you do get a blast hit at the end, and it says, okay, you get a blast hit, but I'm still going to go without.
This one?
Yeah.
Yeah, it does ignore certain blast X hits, and that's because of the probabilistic way that the information is used. And you can see that if you look at the ones that it ignores, they're more like, you know, often the false ones that it ignores. Often it
but
sort of.
It's interesting that this is one that you can predict it.
Oh, this one here? This one. This is on the other strand. Yes, the blast X hit on the other strand. Yeah. 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 So blast hits, exports. It gives you a p-value for the hit. Okay. Now that p-value, most people think, overstates the confidence that hit is correct. Certainly for blast X. So it may say 10 to the minus 6th, okay? But in reality, we know that, you know, about 1% of those are false positives or something, of the 10 to the minus 6 hits or something. So we use an nth root heuristic on the p-value. So we just take the nth root of that p-value. So say the third root would be, you know, 10 to the minus 6 goes to 10 to the minus 2. And then that's how the probability feeds into the genome scan model. And because you still want, you know, more stronger p-values to be stronger and weaker p-values to be weaker, but we just know that people generally, when they run BLAST, they don't use a 0.01 p-value threshold, even though that's what you normally use in science. We just know that the hits between 0.01 and 10 to the minus 6 are just often wrong due to basically, you know, aspects of the model which don't really capture the real biological sequences. And so you have to downweight them, and you use a heuristic. If there was a better way, we would be happy to adopt that. Gary?
Well, I'm curious about that. So
we think...
So there are known genes plus R, and
right.
Is that right? So do you think that you've actually merged two genes together, or do you think the plus R is incomplete?
We think it's incomplete. In this case, there are additional ESTs and cDNA evidence that there's more stuff here. Right. And also, we're pretty sure that this gene is correct. I mean, GenScan predicts the structure. Then, you know, the BLAST X hit has the same, you know, pattern. These are very strong hits. Again, we think this is a real gene. And this also has a couple of ESTs supporting it. I tried to use examples where the annotation was very high quality and complete. But even in these examples, you know, they missed a few things. Yeah, we're not 100% sure on this PLEXR thing, but we're pretty sure that some of these exons are real, and also some of these, we think, again, they got a... it's very common to have a partial cDNA, you know. Yeah?
When we incorporate the BLAST p-value, the BLAST p-value is a p-value on a whole...
On a single piece.
On a single piece, you're getting p-value for
a single piece. Yeah.
Single piece being gapped?
Well, if you use gapped BLAST, then the single piece could have some gaps in it. So, but sort of a local piece. They don't have long gaps. A piece is a region of genomic sequence that, when translated, you know, hits a protein. They sort of correspond to exons generally. Yeah. But sometimes, I mean, often you get hits to many other proteins too. Then we have to use another filter, so you only take the highest, you know, most strongly similar protein in that region. Okay, so there's a genome scan web server. Welcome to use it. So we've done two things with genome scan. One is run it on the entire human genome using BLAST-X similarity to all known proteins. And the other is make a web server so you input, it's like if you ever use the GenScan web server, you input your genomic sequence and then click run, you know, it predicts the gene structure. With genome scan, you have to also give it some proteins, either one protein which you believe is homologous to a gene in that region or several proteins. It's on you to figure out which proteins those are, but you can use BlastX, for instance. We can't provide the BlastX resources that would be.
You mentioned ASPs. ASPs, this particular version of the
code, yeah, we've tried incorporating EST information, but found that it makes the predictions worse. But we don't rule it out. We just think that you need to do more careful filtering of the ESTs or something. Yeah. So this is a summary of when we ran genome scan on the whole human genome. Anyway, I won't go into detail, but there are clear, this is the number of predicted gene density, so number of predicted genes per megabase, and you can see there are there's quite a bit of variability with roughly maybe 4- to 5-fold variability, and chromosome 19 is sort of the mother load for genes, and chromosome 18 is very gene poor and so forth. And this is a summary of some of the current... Yeah, I'm running short on time, so I don't...
No, you don't. It's okay, you can go up. You don't
have short of time. I have like 10 minutes. Okay, oh, my watch is fast. Okay. Anyway, I have 15 minutes. But I do have other things, other topics, so let me...
Just a second.
Okay. Pretty picture, yeah. So you get, so in Finnish, these are complete genes here, complete multi-exon genes, single exon genes. So you get, and this is in Finnish data here with the solid colors, and then the sort of shaded is in draft data. In draft data, you get a lot of gene fragments because the sequence is fragmented. But in Finnish, you know, you get mostly complete genes. And the gene density is actually highly correlated to C plus G composition. If you look down here, C plus G composition, this is a well-known property of human genome. It's a very strong correlation. Yeah, that might be a better representation. Yeah. Yeah. This may not be the. This is not. This is just a pretty picture for. A phase three is finished. Finished sequence.
Finished.
Yeah. Okay. So this is a summary of some of the current efforts to annotate the human genome. Probably the biggest effort is the Ensemble effort at the EBI. And they're using GenScan followed by blast similarity to the predicted proteins, followed by gene-wise alignment of the genomic sequence to a known protein. The NCBI also has an annotation effort using primarily cDNA and EST sequence similarity. This is being done by Jean-Thierry Meek, David Lippmann. Then there's our efforts. We use genome scan, which again is based on ab initio plus protein sequence homology. And there are also various commercial efforts, including that at the neomorphic people, David Hausler, colleagues, now part of Affymetrix, using Genie, and Solera effort using Otto, which I haven't had time to read the Solera paper, so I don't know exactly how it works. And there are also efforts to integrate all of these different people's predicted genes into sort of a systematic indexing system. This is a rough summary of how one might go about annotating the genome. Not exactly what we do, but roughly. So first you want to detect and remove repetitive elements. This is critical for anything based on sequence similarities. We use Repeat Masker by Arian Smith and Phil Green. And then you then want to identify homologs of that genomic region, protein homologs, or maybe cDNA or EST homologs. For this, you could use BlastX. We've actually found that it's more efficient to run GenScan first on the genomic sequence, then you get a set of predicted proteins, then you BlastP those predicted proteins against the protein database, and then find hits. And here we're using the fact that GenScan, if anything, it seems to overpredict. You know, it rarely misses a gene. And also, you don't need to get the entire exon intron structure perfect in order to just identify that there is a homolog in the database. And GenScan plus BlastP is at least an order of magnitude faster than the running blast X of the genomic sequence against a protein database. And this is the most computationally intensive step in this process. And so that's, and we found that the accuracy is almost exactly the same with that step. Anyway, that's just a little comment. And then idea one might then align the protein sequences to the genomic sequence. So here we run a second blast X. Once we've identified homologs that are significant at a certain level, we use a 10 to the minus 5th, 10 to the minus 5 p-value, blast p-value cutoff. Then we do a more sensitive blast X alignment of those proteins to the genomic sequence, and then feed that into genome scan to infer the locations of the genes. Currently, we're thinking about using cDNA information. Currently, we don't use this, but clearly it's an important source of information. And then it would also be nice if you were trying to identify the different alternative splice products of a gene to do some kind of consistency checking on the information, parse the information into different sets, each of which is internally consistent, but perhaps represents different isoforms and do that. But we don't currently do that. Okay, so that concludes the gene finding portion of the talk. And now I want to shift over to a little bit of our work on RNA splicing, that is trying to figure out the RNA splicing code. So GenScan does use some of the information that the splicing machinery uses, specifically the splice signals, but it uses other information that the splicing machinery doesn't use, like the fact that the adjacent exons have to be consistent in terms of open reading frame and so forth. And so we want to also, we'd really like to understand the rules for RNA splicing. That is, how does the splicing machinery pick out the exons and introns in a transcript? This is a summary of some of the signals that are present in primary transcript sequence. This is a 5' splice signal, the 3' splice signal with the polypyrimidine tract here. That's the region rich in CNTs. Then there's a signal called the branch signal, which is quite degenerate in humans. And it's known that U1 SNRP and also U6 SNRP are recognized as a 5' splice signal. So the spliceosome is composed of 5 SNRPs, which are small nuclear ribonuclear protein particles, which are combinations of RNA protein, and also a number of non-SNRP protein factors. So it's a very large molecular machine, sort of on the order of magnitude of the ribosome, made up of both RNA and protein, which assembles dynamically onto the splicing machinery. So that's a difference from the ribosome. The ribosome is a big sort of fixed machine that sort of you thread mRNA through, and the spliceosome kind of assembles in pieces on the primary transcript and then assembles a functional spliceosome, splices, and then disassembles. So it's a more dynamic machine. And in addition to the sort of constitutive splice signals, which I've shown before, there are also, it's known, enhancers in introns or exons, and also repressors in introns and exons. And these are the additional signals which presumably provide the specificity for the splicing machinery, but we don't really know their sequences that well. And I've just shown up here some of the factors that we know bind to particular components of the particular pieces of the primary transcript. Okay. Yep. Well, basically, a number of individual examples are known. So people have, say, done mutagenesis on usually it's not even a complete gene, it's a cloned mini gene, so it's perhaps 3 exons of a gene that they've cloned and are studying, and they do mutagenesis, find that particular sequences away from the splice signals have an effect on the splicing. You can use that to identify enhancers and repressors. The most, I think, well-described class of enhancers are the exonic, the purine-rich exonic enhancers, which are short motifs, maybe 8 to 10 bases long, in exons, usually very purine-rich, that is A and G, mostly A and G, which are known to bind SR proteins. This is a family of splicing factors, which then interact with components of the core splicing machinery and sort of stabilize this interaction, perhaps, and help identify exons. Maybe over 100 bases or something like that, yeah. Right. Yeah. Actually, yeah. There's a nice paper in MCB by from the Chasen lab, anyway, recently, Fairbrother and Chasen, where they inserted random pieces of the human genome into a known exon to see whether they would inhibit splicing. And they found that about a third of randomly chosen pieces of the human genome, of about 150 to 100 bases long, I think, actually inhibit splicing. So that is, there are lots of splicing repressors out there. And yeah, you can also insert putative enhancers, you know, into, and also these enhancer signals that have been identified, you can also, say, insert them into a heterologous gene, you know, some other unrelated gene, and you can find that they generally also have an enhancing effect there. So they're fairly generic in their function. There's a whole, I mean, there's a whole literature on this. There's, you know, dozens of labs, you know, working on splicing, mostly biochemistry, biochemical approaches. Yeah. The exons code for protein, right? Oh, you mean, okay, so yeah, so we have these enhancer signals which are functioning in the splicing of the gene, but they also, you know, have a dual role, sort of have overlapping codes because they also code for protein. And it's interesting that you would want, that you would design the system this way so that you'd have, I mean, you'd think you'd put all the information in the introns and it's sort of unconstrained, but yeah, I mean, there's a lot of evidence that they're in the exon, and I don't know if they're in any particular part of the protein. I don't think that's been looked at. So, as I mentioned, there are these splicing motifs at the 5' and 3' end of introns. And let's skip over this. And the big problem is that these are not sufficient to identify the splice junctions. This just shows that with the best models we have, you can, these are log odds scores for the true splice signals shown here in black, and then log odds scores for decoy splice signals in a set of human transcripts shown here in white. And there's a significant overlap between these two populations. That is, there's a, yep. Well, yeah, it's just for the 5' splice signal. Over human transcripts. The whole transcript. Yeah. Right. And in fact, this actually understates the amount of overlap. The decoys are on a tenfold higher scale. So actually 10 times. Otherwise, it just doesn't make a good picture. I need to find a better representation for this. But there's a huge excess of decoys. There's perhaps 4 or 5 decoys for every true splice site in real transcripts. Those were the scores for everything that has a GT, but we would consider a decoy as something that has sort of a reasonable score that's sort of, you know, in the range of the where the true scores occur. So, yes, yeah, so say, I mean, so the relative entropy for the 5' splice signal is perhaps between 8 and 9 bits, and so that means the average score for a true splice signal is 8 or 9 bits, and if you say look at decoys which have a score of 8 bits or more, you know, those are sort of plausible decoys. And there's a large excess of those, say 3 to 4 decoys per true splice site in human transcripts in general. Yeah? It's roughly additive, but there are also some statistical interactions, yeah, which are pretty interesting. Yeah. Well, we have a lot of statistical data on them, and I mean, there's a lot of experiments on splice signals, but not so much on the statistical interactions. But we have models, but we think we understand what creates a lot of these statistical interactions. So I'm not going to talk about that, but yeah, we have models which capture sort of the most important interactions in, especially the 5' splice signal, and it does help. In that previous picture, This is a simple weight matrix or independence model. This is a first inhomogeneous first order Markov model where you have dependence between adjacent positions. And you can see it does somewhat better at discriminating the two populations. And this is our MDD model, which is it's a model that captures some of the non-adjacent interactions. And you can see it does significantly better. This is just some accuracy data. This is just showing this. That, you know, at a 50% sensitivity level, that it's where you get half of the true sites, you won't, you know, only about 30% of the predicted sites are actually real sites because there's this large excess of the decoys. So you can't predict splice sites in isolation. So how do we tackle this problem of splicing specificity? And we think it's just a very hard problem. We don't want to initially try to work on it in human. We think that's too complicated. So we're looking at lower organisms, specifically C. elegans, Drosophila, and Rhabdopsis. And if you look at the intron length distributions in these organisms, this on, x-axis is on a log scale, okay? You find that there's a distinct peak of short introns, very pronounced in C. elegans and Drosophila, and also in Rhabdopsis, not so much in human. And roughly half of all the introns in C. elegans and Drosophila fall in this very tight range of lengths. For instance, in C. elegans, it's like between 35 and 60 bases contains roughly half of all the introns. And the steepness of this decline here, I believe, implicates selection for this being sort of a preferred intron length. Clearly, there's a minimum length, but then above that, there seems to be selection to have it, you know, sort of in this ideal range. And so we believe that the short introns may be spliced more easily by the splicing machinery. Yeah, humans just don't really have this short intron class to any appreciable extent.
Any data on mice or anything like
that? Mice are similar to humans. Yeah. Okay. So let me just go to my summary slide. We're working on this problem of splice. I didn't expect to get through this talk anyway. But we're working on this problem of RNA splicing and how to identify these additional signals, these enhancers and repressors, and how to integrate those into models. And we'd like to eventually have, you know, something like the genetic code for splicing, you know, splicing code. It's not going to be, you know, a simple table. It's going to be a lot more complicated, you know, maybe tough to write down, but maybe at least implemented in a computer program. And then, I could include some of these into the cool things about RNA. Yeah, just a preview, the cool things about RNA, the coolest things about RNA are ribozymes and RNAi, RNA interference, okay? And then splicing is also pretty cool, so put a little bit about that. And so this is just a review of what I've talked about. It was also for a linguistics conference, so this is grammar stuff. But I think I'll just conclude there. And I just want to thank, I had an acknowledgement slide. But it seems to have been lost. So I want to thank our collaborators, Jerry Pelletier with the RT-PCR experiments, Rufang Ye, a postdoc in the lab who helped with genome scan, and Li Lim, a graduate student in the lab who is working on the splicing stuff. Okay, thanks.